Jason, thanks a lot. Thanks to the African Studies Center for inviting me. It's my first time in Oxford. I have to admit, I always used to mix up Oxford and Cambridge. I mean, if you don't go to places, you have no idea what it actually means. You just know the symbolism, and then you finally arrive, and then you know, okay, this is Oxford. So I'm waiting for the invitation by Cambridge so that I will know the difference. I'm very happy to see so many of you attending this talk. Ethiopia, Somali region, or the Ogaden is not by any means a sexy topic. It's not. And usually when I give talks, I try to give sexy talks somehow. And this talk is not sexy in the sense that it is very much empirical. It is very much focusing just on a couple of years and very much focusing on what one could call peripheral politics. And in the broader sense, Ethiopia is peripheral in terms of global politics. And within Ethiopia, the Somali part, the Somali frontier of Ethiopia, is also peripheral. Nonetheless, this region is of interest to me and to those who, to you obviously, otherwise you wouldn't have come here, and to those who live in the Ogaden. And apart from the empirical issues, and you will soon know what I'm talking about local politics, I think there are three broad themes that should come out of this talk. And these three broad themes can be phrased in terms of three questions. So here we go. First question. Has post-1991 ethnic federalism made self-determination possible for ethno-national groups in Ethiopia? Because that's basically what the Ethiopian Constitution of 1995 promises. It's self-determination, national self-determination. So has ethnic federalism made self-determination possible? My answer will be no. Second question. Are the political dynamics that we observe in the Somali regional state of Ethiopia or the Ethiopian Ogaden, are they exceptional or are they atypical? My answer again will be no. I will argue that what we observe is a type of sovereignty that we can call necropolitics. And here, of course, I refer to Achille Mbembe, as well as a type of sovereignty that expresses itself through a state of exception or through consecutive states of exceptions. Third question. Is history repeating itself in the Ogaden? My answer again will be no. It's kind of a very negative presentation. No. Just like the Swiss People's Party. I will argue that this is not repetition. What we're observing is not repetition in the sense of a linear continuity, but what we observe is what one could call an actualization of a historic mode of governing the Ethio-Somali frontier. Well, one could say that's just an academic way of saying it's repetition, but let's just say it's an actualization of a historic mode of governing the frontier. And this actualization is contemporary, it's modern, it's current, it's transnational, but it is also rooted in established old imperial modes of governing. So very briefly, where my empirical material comes from. I haven't been to Ethiopia since 2008, and I at this point cannot go back to my original field research area. This has been a very difficult place to work, particularly if you work on social, political, economic issues. And after 2007, the Ethiopian government and the regional government have made systematically have shut out journalists and researchers. So the empirical material I have is basically from some of my friends, from some of my old informants. It's also based on news reports, and it is also based on a series of interviews that I have done among the Ogaden diaspora in California and Minneapolis, conducted last year. So, as I will argue in my talk, while much has changed in Somali Ethiopia since 1991, the Ethiopian government in its counterinsurgency against the rebel ONLF, or Ogaden National Liberation Front, recently, and by recently I mean 2006, 2007, reverted to a tradition of highly militarized tactics in its Somali periphery. These tactics have shaped political life in the Ogaden post-2007 and can be described as a type of garrison rule. And I here refer to two things, maybe. One is a classic article by John McCaukies, published in 1979, entitled Garrison Socialism, The Case of Ethiopia. At the time of writing, Garrison Socialism captured, of course, the essence of the Dirk. While socialism disappeared after 1991, Garrison rule did not. At least that's a hypothesis. There's a second link that we can make with Garrison rule, and that's something I just discovered more recently. There's a this seminal article published by Harold Laswell in 1941 on the Garrison state. So we could also, and I will mention this in the conclusion, so we could also discuss to what degree we see a kind of a Garrison state in the Ethiopian Ogaden appearing in recent years. Also, before I start, some disclaimers. Firstly, I will focus mostly on the Ogaden clan family. So this is a particular sub-branch of the Darod clan within Ethiopia's Somali region. Being very much aware that about 2/3 or more, 40% of the population are non-Ogadeni. So when I'm referring to the Ogaden, I'm referring to the Ogaden heartland. I refer to territory that is predominantly inhabited by Ogadenis. I'm not saying that all of it is Ogaden. It's not. This is a very contested issue. Second, the conflict dynamics in the region are much more complex than I will suggest. So I will be a bit on the simplifying and domino-centric side in my talk. Let's start with some background. With the federalization of Ethiopia in 1991, Somalis in Ethiopia, for the first time since their violent incorporation into the Ethiopian Empire at the end of the 19th century, obtained the right to self-administration, including the right to use Somali language for official business and education. As a result of this process, and this is, as you're well aware, not only what happened in the Somali part of Ethiopia, but in all over Ethiopia, as a result, a Somali-Ethiopian political elite has emerged. So basically, ethnic federalism has created new elites, new local and regional elites. So the center of attention of this elite is Jijiga, the regional capital, which is in the north of the region. And here you have the Ethiopian map and with the administrative units, as well as the Somali regional state. New administrative boundaries have been drawn within the region and with neighboring Oromia region, as local clan groups compete for territorial control and political representation within the region. This process has often been accompanied by communal violence. And here, very much similar to Somalia, the concentration of administrative resources that occurs as part of state building politicizes clan relations and ultimately individual sense of belonging. This process has also led to a process of territorialization, by which the boundaries of what used to be more flexible, seasonal clan areas became increasingly circumscribed. And again, this is not particular to Somali regional state, but a process that you will find in many pastoral areas of sub-Saharan Africa. The creation of the Somali regional state on the ruins of the former Ogaden province, pre-1991, and parts of former Eastern Harare and Bale, was first and foremost thought to diffuse tensions and to diffuse Somali contestation, this historic Somali animosity towards the Ethiopian center. The Ethiopian constitution provides all nations, nationalities, and peoples the right to self-determination. So between 1992 and 1994, the region, meaning the Somali region of Ethiopia, was administered by the Ogaden National Liberation Front, which competed as a political party, won the elections, local elections in 92, and then ruled the region from 92 to 94. In 1994, ONLF parliament, regional parliament, took the bold step and basically said, we want to make the constitution a reality. At the time it was a charter. Let's have a vote on secession. Let's have a vote on having a referendum, basically. They did take a vote. The regional capital then was still Gode. Some 95% said, let's go ahead and let's have a referendum. And as a reaction, the Ethiopian military security kicked out the ONLF from the regional administration. So very few people are actually aware of this, but this is the only case so far where a ruling party within Ethiopia has actually tried to implement Article 13. Right? So people always say, you know, it's never going to happen, and it's true, it's never going to happen, but there has been an incident, there has been an example where someone at least tried to make it happen. So since the mid-1990s, the Ogaden, namely the six predominantly Ogaden inhabited zones, and you'll see them here on the map, Gode, which is in the center, I don't know if you can see it, it's far away, Kabri Dehar, Afderfik, Warder, and the Gabur, have been embroiled in a low-intensity conflict between the ONLF and the Ethiopian National Defense Force, or ENDF. ONLF rebels mostly use hit-and-run attacks against Ethiopian troops and convoys, and concentrate the operations in the Ogaden heartland, because this is where they get local support. Although formally administered by local Somalis, Ethiopian Somalis, the so-called insecure areas after 1994 became the fiefdoms of federal military officials as well as national security officials, who are in charge of quelling the ONLF insurgency. So what we have here is formally Ethiopia and ethnic federalism and beautiful self-determination at the federal level. At the regional level, we have a ruling party that is allied to EPRDF. And within the Ogaden heartland, we have a politics that is very much dominated by military commanders. These are the real guys in charge. Since the 2000 elections, Somali region is a de facto one-party state governed by the Somali People's Democratic Party, or SPDP, which was created by and is affiliated with the ruling EPRDF. And as you're well aware of, Ethiopia as a whole is a one-party state. Because in the 2010 elections, there was only 1.5 non-EPRDF candidates in the entire country. So federal parliament and all of the regional parliaments are all belong to the same party. Party leadership within the SPDP rotates regularly, or rather is in permanent crisis, as competing groups within the SPDP, all backed by influential federal patrons, basically federal friends, both in the Ministry of Federal Affairs, in the Ethiopian National Defense Force, meaning the Federal Army, and the National Security Service, and also in the party EPRDF/TPLF, involved in regional politics. So these are alliances between representatives of federal ministries and local/regional Somali-Ethiopian groups. So this is not just a conflict between Somali-Ethiopians versus the center, but different alliances fighting against one another. In the absence of multi-party politics in Ethiopia's Somali region, and we can extend this to the entire Ethiopia, competition has basically shifted from between parties to within party. Right? Within the one-party state, it's no longer a question of which party you will run for, but basically, will you be nominated by the party in order to access power and resources? 2008 local elections did not take place in the region, the Somali region. Somali region somehow follows a different schedule than the rest of Ethiopia. And the SPDP, as I mentioned, won all the seats in the 2010 elections. Let me show you two more maps, which are as interesting as the administrative one. The first one is a very old map showing so-called ethnic groups. I don't think these are ethnic groups. Basically, classic territorial divisions between main Somali clans. And you will see here, if you look at the, you'll see the Ethiopian national boundary, you will see that the biggest clan group is the Darod, meaning Ogaden clan group, which is marked in yellow. And of course, you'll also see that the Ogadenis are also living in, as you know, in southern Somalia, in the Jubaland, so down to Afmado e Kismayo in the south. And you also see relations that they have with their Darod brothers in Puntland. One more map, here a more, maybe more political economy kind of map. Here you will see the Somali region within the broader Somali politics. So basically, we can talk about different Somali states. We have Somaliland, the Republic of Somaliland to the northwest. We have Puntland to the northeast. We have, since about 1 year, a new state called Khartoumo, basically a new Dulbahante state has been created between Somaliland and Puntland, very embryonic. There's different other administrations that you do not pop up. Of course, we have the TFG down there in Mogadishu, and we have the Somali region as part of Ethiopia. And the status of this region is very much contested, and you will immediately find out when you ask people what is the name of this region, right? So some people will say this is Somali region of Ethiopia, this official denomination. Others will say this is Somali Galbeed, meaning this is Western Somalia. Others will say this is Ogaden or Ogadenia, and you can be sure that you're talking to an Ogadeni if this name is mentioned. Again, others will just say it's region 5, because at one point in the first charter, every region just got a number. But again, if you talk to ONLF people, they will say, my home is not a number. So region 5 is maybe not what we should use. I will use alternatively some other region and Ogaden. Also, before I go into this reactivation or actualization of a historic mode of governing that I call the garrison rule, let me give you a brief political history of this region in 2 slides. And I've organized this political history in terms of major periods. We can distinguish schematically a first period of imperial rule that one could call a fiscal military mode. This was the initial time period when the Somali part of what is today Ethiopia was incorporated violently by Menelik and others into the Ethiopian Empire. So relations between the Ethiopian center and the Somali periphery were very much characterized by predatory state behavior, by tax collections, and military expeditions, Samecha, these campaigns, often either to punish people and or to collect taxes. This imperial mode of governing the frontier somehow evolved, and this is not a 0-to-1 kind of change, but gradually evolved, sometimes maintaining old patterns, into a mode that one could call of imperial tutelage between 1920s and 1974. So we still have predatory state behavior, we still have state bureaucratic violence being applied in the Somali periphery, but also increasing bureaucratic control by the establishment of administrative centers, by the transfer, the establishment of Amhara, settlers and administrators. So continued violence, but also the emergence of patrimonial relations, basically alliance between imperial government and selected Somali clans, often in efforts to classic kind of divide and rule. This imperial tutelage period ended with the 1977-78 Ogaden War, and also which occurred 3 years after the end of Imperial Ethiopia. So basically from 77 to 1991, we have a period that one could call of direct repression, but also not only repression, also neglect and marginalization, characterized by continued counterinsurgency against remnants of the WSLF, the Western Somali Liberation Front, and continued population displacements and efforts to contain the mobility of rural people. Now, in 1991, with the coming to power of EPRDF, we have this new political order. And really, it is new in terms of Ethiopian history and in terms of what does it mean to be Ethiopian and what does Ethiopian citizenship mean. The first time it became at least officially possible to be Somali-Ethiopian. These two things previously didn't really go together. And still many would argue that even today they don't go together. But at least formally, with the creation of Somali regional state, as Ethiopian-Somali identity was created, propagated and institutionalized. So Somalis for the first time obtained self-government and administration. What we see though in the actual political practices on the ground is between 92 and 2007 practices that one could call of neo-patrimonialism, neo-patrimonial relations. Now, some of you will say, oh no, not again, another political scientist talking about neo-patrimonialism in Africa because he doesn't have a better concept. Yes and no. No, it's actually, we can even drop the neo. It's basically patrimonial relations between representatives of the federal government who have their friends in the region. Okay, so from the party, from the Ministry of Federal Affairs, from the security apparatus, they all have their counterparts in the region, people, elite politicians, Somali Ethiopians, and they're building basically competing groups trying to kick each other out of the regional government. That's basically what's happening within the SPDP, the Somali People's Democratic Party, and within the regional government. Also, I mentioned ONLF ruling the region from 92 to 94. Then a new party was created, basically EPRDF created a new party of non-Ogadenis, which was then called Ethiopian Somali Democratic League. And since 1998, it's called SPDP, Somali People's Democratic Party. So important thing here, the important message here is, I guess, very strong federal involvement in regional politics, much more than in the central regions of Ethiopia. Because after all, this is what some people refer to as either the emerging regions or the backward regions, right? So Somali region, Afar, Gambela, Beni Shangul, it's kind of backward people. So federal government needs to help them. And to some degree, they actually do need to help them because they do have more capacity. But helping becomes very tricky when you start to involve into Somali politics. Now, after 2007, this is basically my argument, the key point of this talk, we have a return to a previous type of government, a return of garrison rule, characterized, first of all, triggered by an attack by the Ogaden National Liberation Front on the Abole oil field in Deke Habur end of April 2007. This was the trigger. So the insurgency was there before, but this attack, which killed some 90 Ethiopian and Chinese oil workers and security people, triggered a massive counterinsurgency, a counterinsurgency that had already been prepared in the sense of the basic elements had already been there, but it just happened to be intensified. So after 2007, the key dynamics that characterize politics in Somali region of Ethiopia are A, securitization. Security becomes the overarching, not policy goal, but rationale. With security, you can do everything. You can appropriate budget, you can arrest people, you can kill people, you can displace people, and you can get rich. Also, in reference, referring to Achille Mbembe, necropolitics. Mbembe says necropolitics, and he basically says sovereignty is the capacity to decide who gets to live and who gets to die. This is necropolitics. And it often occurs at the edge of empires. Let's just say at the edge of big political entities. This is exactly what happened, particularly in 2008, 2009, necropolitics. Also state of exception. And at the same time, and we'll come back to this in the conclusion, a rhetoric of developmental state. And this is the official rhetoric of Ethiopia, or being a developmental state. So it's both killing people and developing people, which is of course a very interesting, at least analytically, interesting combination. Let me say a few words about the ONLF, and here you have a picture of some five ONLF fighters that was taken by a photojournalist of the New York Times who spent some time with the ONLF in 2007 together with Jeffrey Gettleman, the New York Times East Africa correspondent. The ONLF has been the organization that has challenged the political status quo in the Somali region of Ethiopia most vehemently. It was created by young Ogaden intellectuals who came out of the former Western Somali Liberation Front, or WSLF. So just as a reminder, the WSLF used to be allied and funded by Siad Barre. It was basically a proxy, well, not really proxy, but also non-proxy of Siad Barre fighting against Ethiopia. So in 1984, a small group of many intellectuals basically said, we are being fed up of being instrumentalized by Siad Barre. He's only using the Ogadeni for his grander, you know, Somali politics. He doesn't really care about our issues. So let's have a new organization. We will no longer be Western Somalia. We will be the Ogadeni, right? We'll have our own. This is about Ogadeni. This is not about Western Somalia. Actually, many observers did not get that point. Still, up to today, you'll see often in newspapers people saying, ONLF wants to join Somalia. Well, maybe, but initially that was not the intention, because this is a classic secular ethno-national group fighting for autonomy for its own clan group. So, since its inception, the ONLF underwent several changes, and this is quite interesting, I think. First of all, the initial ONLF was basically a diaspora group. It was a group of exilees living mostly in Arab Gulf states, in Syria, intellectuals, some in Europe, and some within the region. Basically, exile kind of politics. In 1991, when the Derg fell and EPRDF came in, EPRDF needed a counterpart in the Somali region. They do need ethno-national vanguard political parties in all of the regions. So what do we do in Somali region? There was no one really around. Some old guys from the WSLF were still hanging around. They took some of those in into the transitional conference in London, and then basically said, ONLEF, why don't you guys, you know, join this new political order? So the ONLEF came into the region more by accident, more by chance. Basically exile politics who came into the region after EPRDF took over. And they basically took over the region because they're saying, we are Ogadenis. And it was only in 1991 that they started to build up their political machinery within the region by opening up, you know, party offices, recruiting and training cadres and all these things, all the stuff that political parties usually do. So first an exile group, then a political party in power from 1992 to 1994, and only then a rebel group. Because in 1994, ONLEF says, there's this beautiful Article 39, let us be the first one to take a vote on a referendum. It didn't happen, they were kicked out of power, some of them were killed, they basically had to go to the bush, and it was only then that they started to build up their military capacities and became a rebel group. Of course, if you know the history of TPLF / EPRDF, this was the other way around. It was a rebel group that became governing political party. Right? This is interesting because we are currently in peace negotiations between the ONLF and the TPLF, so we have former rebels who are now rulers and former, maybe regional rulers who are now rebels, talking to one another. The ONLF claims to represent all Somalis in eastern Ethiopia, and if you meet ONLF cadres, that is the story that they will give you. In actual fact, they draw predominantly support from the Ogaden clans. ONLF has strong support from the Ogaden subclans of predominantly Reb Isaac and Reb Abdille, which together form Mohammed Zubair. Also some support from Bargeri, Makahil, and Tolamoge, but not from other clans. But they will always say, we are a national army, but every non-Ogadeni will tell you that this is not the case. There are also tensions within the ONLEF, not only between certain personalities, as you would expect in politics, but also between some of the bigger Ogadeni clans, particularly between Reb Isaac and Reb Abdille. Together are Mohammed Zubair, but there's always issues to what who is ONLEF, more of a Reb Isaac or more of a Reb Abdille organization. There have also been tensions between leading personalities, particularly between the General Osman, who's the current chairman, and the former foreign minister of ONLEF, Sirat Dolal, who I was told was a personal colleague / friend of Tony Blair at one point, and who in 2009, to increase they had studied together, that's the explanation. In 2009, Dolal came back to the region because he wanted to make himself more relevant, also in military terms, and he was killed when he entered the region. And there were lots of rumors that his killing by regional militia was the result of conflict within the ONLF. So there are tensions within this organization, also tensions within a more secular nationalist kind of tradition of ONLF, and the more, let's say, pan-Somali Islamist kind of identity. And you will see that even though ONLF, typologically speaking, is a secular, ethno-national rebel group, when it comes to recruiting fighters or mobilizing people, they will at times make reference to Islamic identities, and typically saying, let's fight against Amhara Christian dominators because we're all Muslim and we're all Somalis. The ONLF maintains strong links with dozens of Ogaden diaspora communities. So in every country in Europe, you will find an ONLF chapter. You will also find women groups, youth groups, and these have become, in recent years, much more present. They have become more present online, in social media, but also in the public space. And they have also started to develop a rhetoric of Ogaden genocide, very much trying to echo the Darfur kind of genocide rhetoric. And you will see that they have t-shirts saying, Ogaden genocide, why is no one doing anything? And some of these younger Ogadeni are more nationalist, are more radical than some of the older Ogadeni nationalists, with a typical diaspora kind of phenomena, of course. Also, ONLF has been drawing on Eritrean support since 1998 and maintains a tactical alliance with the Oromo and Sidama Liberation Front. Not that the latter is very meaningful, but at least the Eritrean connection is. Because there were troops trained, some ONLF troops trained in Eritrea, and there's also speculation that the attack on the Abole oil field was only made possible because of Eritrean involvement. And this, of course, irritated and annoyed Ethiopian government very much. In the past, the UNLF has also clashed with Al-Shabaab in Ethiopia and Kenya. And this is a conflict driven by different political ideologies, but also competition over influence in southern Somalia's Juba Valley, Kismayo, this other important Ogaden hub. Despite escalation of the UNLF insurgency in the last couple of years, paralleled with mounting casualties and an intense propaganda war that you can also follow on Ethiopian Somali television or on YouTube clips, on websites, the UNLF has always remained open to negotiations with the Ethiopian government. And different rounds of negotiations have been taking place, most of them unsuccessful, but most recently two direct encounters have taken place in Nairobi in September and October last year. And towards the end of my presentation, I'll give you a short analysis of what happened during these talks. Also in 2010, the Ethiopian government had signed with great fanfare and as part of a big public relations effort, a peace agreement with a small UNLF breakaway faction led by Saladin Maro. It was basically a small group of Mokahil Ogadenis that it was not significant, does not represent UNLF, but nonetheless, this was used for propaganda purposes. More importantly, in 2010, the Ethiopian government also signed a peace agreement with the United Western Somali Liberation Front, a remnant of an Islamist group that basically was looking for a retirement package, saying we can no longer fight, we have no more place for us in southern Somalia with Al-Shabaab, please allow us to come back, we'll give up our arms, give us some appointments, give us some land, and give us some licenses to conduct business and make some money. Now, with this background, and I'm sorry for taking so much time, but it's just a short summary of the political history. I'd like to come back to this metaphor about the return of garrison rule in the Ogaden. Garrison rule in Ethiopia has its historic precedence in the Ketema, or meaning the fortified military structures that were set up by the expanding imperial army in its conquest of the southern and eastern parts of the country in the 18th and 19th century. And if you're interested in this, you will of course look at the classic book on the Southern Marches by Dunham and Wendy James. These katamas were at the center of what were historically garrison towns, such as, for example, Jijiga, the regional capital of Somali region state. Over time, they developed into local administrative centers and markets. The tradition of the katama lived on in the military outposts which the Derg established before and after the 1977-78 Ogaden War. And if you look at maps produced by the Ethiopian Mapping Agency, you look at maps, topographical maps of the region, that were produced in the 70s and 80s, but not updated, at least not in the last 5 years. When you look at the maps of Somali region of the Ogaden, they will often not contain the name of cities, but they will just say military camp. Okay? So this is this perspective by the center. The center views the Somali periphery in terms of military outposts, in terms of security. These towns do not have Somali names. They're just military outposts. Part of a structure that basically tries to control the buffer zone towards Somalia. Once it had stabilized the Ogaden following turbulent events in Ethiopia and Somalia in the beginning of the mid-1990s, the EPRDF, the new power, manned the Ogaden's military camps with its own soldiers. These present-day garrisons are of strategic importance for Ethiopian national security. They are the nodes of Ethiopia's security dispositive in its Somali borderlands. It is in these military camps, in Gode, in Degabur, in Kebre Dahar, in Fik, and elsewhere, where Ethiopian National Defense Force commanders and intelligence officers, often former TPLF soldiers, embody and enact the authority of the federal government, making sure that, if you permit some sarcasm, the constitutionally guaranteed right to self-determination doesn't get out of hand. Military commanders play influential roles in everyday politics in the region's insecure areas, where they effectively command authority over local Somali administrators. And often local officials at the Wareda, at the district level, need the approval of these military commanders. And often the approval is linked to kickbacks. Right? So you will pay a military officer, and in return you will have his support and you will become part of the district administration. And the same happens at the regional level. What is the role of military garrisons in the Ogaden? Essentially, it is to discipline and punish the enemies of the Ethiopian state, both assumed and real ones. The military works with local informers to monitor and survey the local population in the epic quest to find out who supports the enemies of the state and who not. In addition to serving as the basis to launch campaigns against ONLF, the camps are also sites of detention centers. Already before, but particularly after 2007, after this counterinsurgency was triggered by the ONLF attack on the oil field, makeshift prisons have multiplied in the Ogaden. ONLF members and suspected supporters are held in these facilities, mostly without being brought to court, and often they are tortured during interrogation, and I have talked to some of these torture victims. In Jijiga alone, there are, or at least there were some 2 years ago, 6 detention and interrogation centers where suspects are being held. Among them are the heavily guarded military camp Garab Ase, literally Red Shoulder or Red Soil, some 2 kilometers outside of Jijiga. Ayar Hail, or Air Force, the former central jail, a correctional jail run by the federal police, or what is locally known as Jail Ogaden, a detention center next to the former customs post, which held some 1,500 Ogadeni from all walks of life in 2009. So we have these detention centers both within the federal military, the federal police, and in what used to be regional prison structures. Furthermore, garrison rule materializes beyond the narrow perimeter of the military camp. In 2008, the regional government, so Somali regional government, created a new militia known as the Liu, or special police. Liu means special in Marina, which now consists of some 15,000 troops. It is tasked with fighting the ONLF and consists of both Ogadeni and non-Ogadeni Somalis, but predominantly of Ogadeni Somalis. So these are Ogadeni Somalis working for the regional militia tasked to fight against ONLF. This was basically a strategy to indigenize the conflict, or one could also say to outsource the dirty work from the Ethiopian National Defense Force, from the Federal Army, to this regional militia. Or one could say it was an effort to implant garrison rule in the Ogaden body politic. Let me talk a bit more about the counterinsurgency as a kind of total war strategy, as it was applied in 2007, 2008, 2009. So I mentioned this counterinsurgency campaign was triggered by the Abole attack. And this Abole attack, the attack on this oil field, was a veritable humiliation for the Ethiopian government, particularly in its relation to the Chinese government. Because all of a sudden you have dead Chinese workers, and the Chinese government saying, what is going on? And the Ethiopian government was caught by surprise. This was also linked to basically the deployment of troops into Somalia. So ONLF was making use of this temporary weakness, temporary inattention by the Ethiopian Federal Army. So it was a loss of face, right, by on the side of the Ethiopian government. In April 2007, the Prime Minister's then advisor Abai Tsehai, a very old former TPLF veteran, ENDF General Yunis Samora, and the commander in charge of Ethiopia's Eastern Hararge Division, and it's the Eastern Division that rules this part of Ethiopia, imposed a commercial blockade on the Ogaden heartland with the objective of cutting off ONLF from all material supplies. This blockade was ruthlessly enforced during several months and blocked not only the circulation of goods and trucks, but also of rural dwellers, of pastoralists. As a result, foodstuff prices exploded and livestock prices declined as a result of violent clashes between the army and ONLF rebels. This was amplified by poor rains, and as a result, we had a serious humanitarian crisis in mid-2007, leading even to a UN humanitarian assessment into Somali region of Ethiopia. And if you're interested in the history of this, UN UN humanitarian mission, you can read the article I wrote with my colleague Benedict Korf entitled "Agamben in the Ogaden, Violence and Sovereignty in the Ethio-Somali Frontier." And you'll basically see that the entire humanitarian mission was orchestrated. Along the ways where the UN traveled, food supplies had been distributed previously in a kind of show that some food aid has reached the population. Local elders were intimidated, they were not allowed to talk freely to the UN. And most strikingly, the UN basically was not allowed by the Ethiopian government to publish its results, because it had produced both a humanitarian assessment and assessment in terms of human rights. But the UN basically decided to keep quiet and just play the kind of game that donors play, that donors play all of the time in Ethiopia. In parallel, ENDF's counterinsurgency on Kabri Dehar, Warder, Degabur, and Fig zones was going on. It was guided by a total war strategy, inasmuch as the Ethiopian military not only sought to destroy ONELEF, but to cut off the rebels from food supplies. At one point, even arresting lactating camels in Aware. According to one source, some 150 Al-Ittihad fighters, 700 ONELEF fighters, and 1,000 civilians were killed in clashes in the first 3 months only of this campaign. This was between April and August 2007. And Human Rights Watch documented some of these extrajudicial killings, rapes, and torture cases in a report published in 2008. Also, between 1995 and mid-2007, the Ogaden Human Rights Committee, which is a local human rights organization, compiled and documented 2,395 extrajudicial killings with names of victims, as well as 1,945 rape cases and more than 3,000 forced disappearances of suspected or assumed ONELEF supporters by Ethiopian security forces and this new regional militia. Numerous settlements were forced to close down, so in addition to targeting the ONELEF, cutting off material supplies, there was also an effort to restrict the mobility of people and to control movement. And you will often see at the local, in the level of towns, that the military will organize appeals. Basically, all the population has to show up and they will check who is here, who is missing. And if someone has been traveling, the person will be interrogated. Where have you been? Sometimes arresting people, because the Ethiopian security will always be worried that they have been out in the bush supporting ONELEF fighters. Yet the iron fist approach by the Ethiopian government, which was intended to suppress civilian support to ONELEF, turned out to be counterproductive, as ONELEF at least partly managed to expand its zone of operation, at least at the beginning of the counterinsurgency. Later on, this changed with the creation of this new Liu militia, this Liu police, which was quite effective in reducing the ONELEF. The massive crackdown on the Ogaden population after April 2007 not only affected the Ogaden, but also other clan groups in the region, whom the military suspected of indirectly supporting the ONELEF. For example, the Isak, who are living just north of the Ogadenis, the neighbors of the Ogadeni, and who are often at loggerheads with the Ogadeni. Also, intermarriage also happens. As part of the Ethiopian army's effort to disentangle the ONELEF rebels from its civilian supporters, it held a series of meetings with non-Ogadeni clans in 2007. These were systematic meetings, basically clan by clan. They have to meet, they will appoint, they will invite their elders, their local politicians, and they have to meet with the military, with the federal military and other party members, and they will basically give them a sermon and also ask people to accuse themselves of supporting ONELEF. This is the kind of tradition that EPRDF uses, coming from the TPLF, coming from the Gimgema, of basically evaluating, but also of criticism and self-criticism, which is basically used nowadays to get rid of people, also to get people into new positions. In these meetings, elders and community leaders were questioned, subclan by subclan, whether they had links with the enemy. The military and local informants pressurized the clans to identify collaborators with ONELEF. This strategy had been initiated by the federal government and was called Clean Yourself, or Isnaditin in Somali. In return for cooperation with the military and regional militia, local clans opposing ONELEF were rewarded with development aid. But the clean yourself strategy also infuriated local Somalis, as this quote here demonstrates. This is a quote by an Isak elder in a meeting with this Ethiopian military. It was relayed to me by a good dear friend of mine. And this elder was saying, so after the interrogation, he was saying, Menelik, Haile Selassie, and the Derg came here and said, you are Ethiopians. We said no. You, meaning you, EPRDF, you came and we accept to be Ethiopians. So this is basically, it's been tactical here. But you have not changed your behavior and you are always hiding something. the state of exception in Ethiopia-Somali region, the state of exception that we saw, these emergency powers that came into being after 2007, is not recent, but is part of a recurrent strategy by which central rulers from the imperial period of Emperor Haile Selassie to the military regime of Mengistu Haile Mariam to today's EPRDF govern the country's peripheral borderlands. And the political violence that we observe derives from these recurrent states of exceptions, and they must be seen as governmental techniques, as emanations of sovereignty, rather than as the result of local disorder or anomie. For example, the Ogaden was under a formal state of emergency between 1956 and 1964. After the Ogaden War of 77-78, the Ethiopian-Somali frontier remained caught in a de facto but not officially declared state of emergency, as army officials enjoyed discretionary powers in the counterinsurgency against remnants of WSLF. The German constitutional lawyer Carl Schmitt famously wrote that sovereign is he who proclaims the state of exception. Souverän ist, wer über den Ausnahmezustand entscheidet. By declaring a state of emergency, or a state of exception, the Ethiopian state decides when law is applicable and when not, as well as who is within and who is outside of the law. As for example, after the April 2007 attack on the Abole airfield. Over time, states of exception are no more exceptional, but they become the rule. They are normalized as a strategy of governing the Ogaden. And if you're interested in this, I will refer you one more time to this article, because we basically come up with different strategies of exception. One is politics of bare life, which are basically tactics to kill and starve enemy bodies. One is a strategy of encamping the Ogaden. And I referred to this when I said this, there's no access to the Ogaden. Very, very difficult to get access for humanitarian organizations, impossible for journalists, and also for researchers. And the Ogaden is one of the few regions in the world, I could say, remaining where you basically you have no access, and also in terms of information coming out of the region. It is really, by many standards, an exception worldwide. So, one more empirical vignette. This is from a former judge, a young person who used to be a judge in Somali region, and he was arrested by the Liu police, and the basically operating Liu police who were directed by who is now the regional president, by Abdi Ile, and they were charged to arrest him because he had been critical of the regional government, and he was interrogated and beaten up. So he gave me an account of the interrogation, and he told me, so the senior security official who had caught him asked me, "Are you AM? So are you Ahmed Mohammed or whatever?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "You are under arrest." I said, "Why?" And then he slapped me in the face, and another security official did the same. They both beat me together. I told them that I am a judge and that I have legal immunity. And he said, "I don't care. You're anti-peace element. We know what you do." So basically, even the person who represents the law is outside of the law. This is basically the point we're making about the state of exception. And this is not the only person. So many people have been tortured in these prisons. What happened as a result of the counterinsurgency was basically the formation of a new local elite through a process of securitization. And in a nutshell, it was the head of the security, of what is called as the security office or the security sector bureau, a person who was appointed as the head of the security office in 2008, and in 2010 became the regional president. And this by the name of Abdi Mohamed Omar, or he's usually known as Abdi Ile. He's an Ogadeni from Degeabur. He basically came through the security apparatus and basically took charge of regional politics. And this person very much resembles, if you do comparative politics, we could say he plays a very similar role to Khadirov in Chechnya. As long as he stays within the federal security agenda, he can do whatever he wants to. His militia can kill people. He sometimes used to direct them to victims, basically saying, "You should kill this person, you should kill this woman, you should rape this woman." So a number of human rights abuses that come directly out of this Liu police that he created and oversaw. And the Ethiopian government basically accepted it. Also, this Liu police does not have does not really have a legal status. It's basically an irregular kind of security force. In addition to the Liu police and securitization, of course, there's also a political economy of suspicion. Basically, by accusing people, you will get rid of them. They will go to prison, they will be tortured. And there are sometimes, these informants are locally known, some people jokingly call them the non-liars, or Ben Mashega, basically meaning the informers, the informants are not lying, because if they accuse you, if I accuse Devanesen of being Onelev, he will be Onelev, right? He will end up in prison. So these guys never lie, meaning these are performative acts that become reality. Accusing someone of being Onelev has repercussions. The person, his family, relatives will go to prison, will disappear for a shorter or longer time period. Therefore, we can see three generations of political leaders in Ethiopia's Somali region. We have the old generation here, and here used the example of Opti Jibril, he's all the way on the left, and old generations of political leaders of the SPDP, who basically tried to more or less successfully to straddle the pressures both by the federal government and these local and regional interests. This old generation of leaders was kicked out or ended in 2008 when President Daud came to power. A new generation of leaders that were trained in the Ethiopian Civil Service College were all loyal to basically products of EPRDF who went through the party school. And again, these leaders were replaced by people from the security apparatus, and that's why today we have Abdi Ile in power. Let me speed up with my presentation. The recurrence of garrison rule has its historic, if not precedence, then it connects historically to past incidences and past legacies of insurgencies and state violence. And let me just mention the uprising by the Nasrullah movement in the 1950s, the armed uprising by Macht al-Dahir, or what Somalis organizations refer to as the Gesh, the armed forces, was fighting. These were basically Somali-Ethiopian officers working for the Imperial Army who revolted against Haile Selassie in 62. And they lost the battle, obviously. Later on, the WSLF, and nowadays, the ONLF. So if you talk to older Ogadeni, what happens today in the Ogaden, they will see it in light of all these past insurgencies, and they will see a continuity, just like when you talk to Palestinians, they will make direct reference to Nakba, right? So they will, very similarly, Ogadenis will refer to these legacies of state violence. Also, very interestingly, this is tragic but interesting from an academic viewpoint, the counterinsurgency measures employed by the Imperial Army, and I only was able to conduct some interviews with some of these older Ogadeni persons, are 90% identical to what EPRDF is doing now. The targeting of civilian populations, extrajudicial killings and disappearances, the use of exemplary violence, exactly the same. Imperial government used to cut off the head of rebel leaders and ask everyone in town to come to the central marketplace and show the head. The federal military for several years now, for 15 years, has been known to kill ONLEF fighters and then place them in central squares. For example, in Gode, they'll place them in the central square and no one is allowed to touch the body for at least 2 or 3 days. ICRC sometimes will try to negotiate the exemplary violence. The destruction of homes and villages, burning of villages. Identical tactics used in the 60s and some 3-4 years ago. The same with arrest, torture, and release. So often people are arrested, then they are tortured, and then they are released. Basically, you buy people off, and then your relatives will come out of prison. The one thing that is maybe new is this increase of sexual violence and rape, which apparently did not happen, or to a much lesser degree, during imperial times and even during times of the Derg. Let me skip this slide, and I'll just have two more slides. One has to do basically, because I thought you might be interested in this, has to do with this current peace talks between the ONLF and the Ethiopian government. So, there have been, despite this insurgency, there have been talks behind the scene between ONLF and the Prime Minister's office for some time. This has happened in the 1990s. At one point, three ONLF emissaries were killed by the Ethiopian military. So that didn't, that was not very encouraging. Then for some years, no more talks. In 2005, again, an attempt by Ogaden elders to mediate, kind of shuttle diplomacy between the prime minister's office and the ONLF. And I had the chance to interview one of these Ethiopian elders who was basically carrying the letters between the prime minister's office and the ONLF commander in the field. In 2005, the sticking point was that Ethiopia refused A, to have a third party, and B, they didn't want negotiations to basically to occur in another country that it was not to their liking. So they said it can happen in Sudan, but it should not happen in the countries that ONLF had suggested. Obviously, ONLF wanted something like Scandinavian country or the UK. So the 2005 shuttle diplomacy came to an end. In 2010, basically based on an initiative by Kenyan Ogadenis, a new round of pre-talks began to emerge. And there were two formal meetings, one in September, one in October last year. So there were two delegations by ONLF and the Ethiopian government, particularly military and intelligence, and they met in Nairobi as a kind of pre-talks, so-called talk about talks. The first meeting was successful in the sense that nothing happened, but at least they said that we will continue talking. But the second meeting basically ended in failure, as the Ethiopian insisted that ONLF accept the Ethiopian constitution as a precondition. And this is, of course, very funny, because you would say, well, why not? Why not accept the Ethiopian constitution, right? And the mediators are also, the Kenyan facilitation team is also a bit at a loss, because they say, why should the ONLF not accept the Ethiopian constitution, because it has this beautiful Article 39, has all these beautiful things in it. But if you look at the real practices, we know that this phrase of you need to accept the Ethiopian constitution is basically, it's basically code for you need to submit to EPRDF. And that is why ONLF will not accept the Ethiopian constitution, even though technically and legally it would make sense to accept it. So the real issues and the talks are stalled now, but there are efforts to revive them, have to do with representation. In my view, neither the ONLF represents Ethiopian Somalis of the region. It basically represents, it's a narrow representation of Ogadenis. Neither does the Ethiopian side. These federal security and military persons do not represent Ethiopian political elite, particularly since the death of Meles Zenawi. It's again the military that took over representation in the talks. The other issue is the referendum. The central demand by ONLF and the supporters is to have basically to allow Ogadenis to have a vote on what should be happening. Should there be secession? Should there be integration into Ethiopia? Or maybe even joining Somalia? And the tragic thing is that neither one of these options is feasible or viable. But on the other hand, also Ethiopia has not much to offer, because it will never allow any group to actually have a vote on a referendum. Another issue has to do with the oil, and we can go into this maybe later. Let me just conclude with the following observations. What are the consequences of the return of garrison rule in the Ethio-Somali borderlands in recent years? Firstly, I think one consequence is this actualization or remaking, reproduction of trauma, antagonism, and boundary making in the Ethio-Somali borderlands. Very clearly. In the future, this will stand out again as a period of antagonism and of trauma. Secondly, it shows both the rise and fall of self-determination in federal democratic Ethiopia. Ethnic federalism has failed to resolve the national question in Ethiopia. In other words, if the Ethiopian constitution were a hypothesis, the Ogaden, or rather political developments in the Ogaden after 2007, are its refutation. Contrary to Northeast Kenya, where considerable parts of the Somali population identify as Kenyan or Kenyan-Somali, still very few Somalis in Ethiopia voluntarily identify themselves as Ethiopians, even though the number is also increasing, and there are more people who identify as Ethiopian-Somali. Instead, we observe in Eastern Ethiopia a return to coercive interventions by the central government, which I have resumed under the broad heading of garrison rule. Ethiopia is thus, at least in its Somali periphery, a garrison democracy, And that's basically my new proposal. Ethiopia is a garrison democracy, propagating democracy and development, but in actual terms operating like a garrison state, at least in some of its regions. Yes, my last point has to do with the role of state and security more broadly in the Somali territories, but I will finish on this note. And sorry for taking so long.